Shalom, shalom. Hello, hello. We are live on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Welcome to Prag Magic. I am Keats Ross, and I am with a great old friend, the part and parcel of the occult podcasting triangle from, God, it's been like years now since we started these kind of ventures. But yeah, good friend Eric Arneson of Arnomancy. Good to have you here, brother.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. It's good to, I mean, we haven't podcasted or done anything like this together in years. So this is, it's great crazy to do it again.
Yeah. No, it's been so long, but, you know,
we've both become like famous millionaire podcasters by now. I mean, I can't believe it. Just
maybe one of us and not me, but not me. Yeah. But yeah, good to see you. You couldn't, we saw each other in Portland a couple weeks ago, and it just, yeah, it reminded me, like, all of the wellspring of knowledge and personage that's around me, and sometimes I can get so caught up in my own brain and oeuvre or art barfs or whatever that I forget to, you know, check in and keep up with everybody, and it's so silly because mm-hmm. you're doing so much great stuff. And you know, your podcast has always been wonderful, from My Alchemical Bromance to Arnomancy. I think I was your last My Alchemical Bromance guest, too.
You were. I remember we were recording at the Muddy Rudder in Portland.
Yeah. I miss the Muddy Rudder.
Me too. Yeah, I was just thinking about, I think that was the last time we recorded anything together? I think that was.
No, so there was an ill-fated... and Alex did a
the last episode. I believe I have the audio for that, but I don't think it's usable because I think we were, I mean, not only were we perhaps not in our right minds when we were doing that, but we were like sitting right next to the speaker, the music speaker in the bar, so you know, it's probably all like George Thorogood and Led Zeppelin
right
over us.
Yeah, that's hilarious. I remember specifically Alex and I getting into a funny argument about why it's pronounced machinations or machinations and why it's not pronounced machinations. And it must have lasted like 20 minutes of just me and him, like me doing a stupid deconstructionist, like, but really, if you think about linguistically, he's like, shut up, what are you talking about?
I mean, it's machine, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was funny. But anyways, again, another beautiful synchronous thing was in reinvigorating this podcast or this project or, you know, broadcasting in the esoteric medium, you know, it's going to be so good to hear, you know, your developments as a broadcaster. But not only that, like your, you know, your oeuvre of actually teaching magic and doing these classes and, you know, being somewhat of a kind of, I don't know, esoteric coach of sorts. I think I heard someone use the title, and I don't like this title, but something like esoteric, what do they call it? Personal trainer, which wasn't a fan of.
I don't know that I would be okay with that particular label. And primarily because I rarely do sort of like the one-on-one sort of like coaching kind of thing.
You're probably more of a teacher, like classroom, teach classes in person. Yeah.
In person and online. Yeah. I've been a public speaker for a really long time. Like I think I started public speaking in like 2005, 2006. But I started doing classes online when the pandemic thing hit. Because I'd been teaching in person at a local occult shop, Invoke, and then the pandemic hit, and I was like, ah, what am I supposed to do? It was really fun to get that extra money every month. But also, there's a lot of pressure on you when you're like putting classes together to sort of consolidate your thoughts and like put them together in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I kind of enjoy that. You know, I have to spend like a lot of time with the source material, and I make all these notes, and then I sort of distill it down into like slides, and then I never really like write out my talks.
Yeah. You
know, I'll have like notes that I'll follow, but I have to know the material well enough that I can just sort of speak with some talking points in front of me.
Right. There's got to be an element of jazz to it. Like, you understand the theory and the skills, but yeah, you need to be able to improvise and
yeah.
You know, it's something I have a teaching background as well, but I've never really maneuvered it into kind of this realm, even though, you know, I'd love to. But I think what got me over that hump of me thinking, like, why would anybody want to listen to me or anything, was the realization that for me to better comprehend all of this would be to teach it. You know what I mean? It's almost like
for sure
an education in teaching itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, like, I've only taught courses, you know, things that were more than one class a few times. And that's even more of a challenge because then you get feedback on how you've been doing.
Right.
Right. Like they come back and you have to be like, did anything I say stick?
Right.
Did I actually teach? and that's definitely, that was definitely an eye opener. The first multi session course I taught was about cryptography.
That's right.
That might have been before I started podcasting, actually, wasn't it? That's a long
time. I remember you did a cryptography one, and I remember you did a sigil one, I think was like right before I left. You did, it was at Invoke, I believe. Yeah
But by then I was already podcasting, but yeah, right. the cryptography one was even earlier than that, and it was kind of crazy because I had, you know, I'm a college dropout, and so I don't always, yeah, but like, if you, it doesn't matter if you go to college or not, if you do something for many, many years, you're still going to like learn a lot about it. And one of the things that I kind of had failed to learn or failed to realize was that I had accumulated a good amount of like introductory knowledge that just isn't at all common. You know, and so I went in there thinking like, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm going to teach people this stuff. They're going to love it. And like the first class, it's all just like, what's this mean? What's this mean? And I'm like, oh, shit, I have to go even further back than this.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And so that was something I thought about that a lot when I started doing classes on occult and magic, because it's super easy. I mean, the occult world, the occultosphere, or whatever the hell, are we allowed to make up words?
Yes, I do all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's filled with like people who have been nerding out on it for decades.
Right.
And when you're somebody who's been nerding out on it for decades, you kind of tend to talk to the people who have been nerding out on it for decades. But when you want to take this material and make it accessible to other people who haven't, you know, been doing that but still want to get the benefits of it, you really have to like take a step back and be like, okay, what's considered basic knowledge here?
Right.
It makes me think of something that when I was in college, I was studying physics, and it makes me think of something that my intro to physics professor taught, which was something like, he hated going to faculty parties because every physicist is expected to know all the basics of English literature, right? Like, oh, of course you've read Dickens. Oh, of course you've read, you know, Pride and Prejudice, where everybody's read those books, you know, something like
standardized
that.
Knowledge. Yeah.
Right. Except that the most basic physics stuff is not standardized knowledge. So like if he brings up Isaac Newton, people are like, who? Or they'll be like, what? They'll be like, oh, you mean that guy with the apple? And he was like, it's so frustrating. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. There is a fine line. I think there are folks who do the introductory side really well. Mm-hmm. I think there are people that do the highbrow, highfalutin really well. And there also needs to be a space for, the kind of permanent intermediary, you know, types that are like, you know, many years practicing, but still even kind of deconstructing the basics and like, you know, still learning, still applying everything and still doing so.
Yeah.
I do see those factions, and I know that you, you know, you in envelop all three of those, especially with the podcast and with teaching. Mm-hmm. You said that it kind of, you know, the pandemic really like set you on the path of doing more of the teaching. Did you notice, because mm-hmm. there's been a lot of talk like of the culture bump because of the pandemic. And I think through like just general desperation, a lot of people were kind of turning to magic.
Yeah, I don't know that it's desperation, though. I'm not sure that I would call it desperation. I think that one of the things that happened during the pandemic is, you know, everybody's life was upset.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is, you know, literally part of the magical path, right? The path of the initiate is like everything gets upset. You know, things get turned upside down. And I don't know that it's necessarily desperation that would drive people to magic because of that, as much as a realization that things aren't exactly as they seem. You know, systems mm-hmm. aren't as stable as they seem, or life isn't as regular and predictable as it seems, you know? So
sure.
I think it may have also been sort of a sense of curiosity. Like, if that part of my life wasn't true, what else isn't true?
Yeah.
You know?
And it's enriching the mundane because now you're forced to kind of sit and meditate with it, you know,
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because, you know, a lot of us ended up stuck. Everybody was stuck at home, mm-hmm. you know, almost everybody. And so you had to spend a lot of time with your own brain.
Yeah.
Your own mind. So I think it was more that. I guess I just have maybe a base faith in people that they were doing it out of curiosity and exploration instead of desperation. But
sure.
But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
I mean, maybe, yeah, just because of the drama of the word desperation. But I think it's still, you know, based in truth that, yeah, a lot of us do come to these outside, you know, metaphysical tendrils of things because, you know, we're not being met. We're not communing with anything anymore. Mm-hmm. Things are breaking down, you know, outside, within, whatever. And so it makes sense that during this like huge somatic rift that we're all sharing that, you know, people were diving more into like these mediums, you know? And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you've noticed since, because you were doing, you know, you've been doing, magic theme broadcasting before the pandemic, you're mm-hmm. going to continue to do it ad infinitum. Like, have you noticed a sort of like a cultural like shift, like a drop off or a trend? Because I keep hearing a lot of broadcasters talk about, you know, there was a huge fad for a moment or something, and a lot of people kind of shuffled out. And I wonder if they're meaning, you know, because of the pandemic bump or what.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I honestly don't know. You know, I mean, I watch my podcast numbers, and there definitely was a point at which the numbers kind of bumped upwards, like listeners bumped upwards, and then it kind of plateaued out. Mm. And that was definitely sometime over the past couple of years, but it's really hard to know what the cause of that was. You know, I think that there's definitely, like, it felt like tarot got incredibly popular for a little bit. You know, I mean, there are definitely fads, but I'm not sure how much they have, how much, that's a good question. I wish that I had an answer. I'm trying to figure out, like, and I honestly don't know. I mean, a lot of it is because of my own exposure. You know, I stopped using Facebook and I stopped hanging out on Twitter and I stopped doing Instagram, and that definitely, you know, made my exposure to the occult world a lot smaller. But I also don't know, so it's hard for me. It would all be anecdotal. I don't really have any.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm looking for, because I know there isn't really like an absolute answer to it. I think it's more me kind of rediscovering over and over again that there is no monoculture. There's no, you know, everything is kind of cyclical and these things. And as somebody who's never cared or looked at like analytics like that, I just find it interesting that maybe there was kind of like a mass movement towards it and away from it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure. I was just wondering, as somebody, you know, as long and storied as your career is, if you've noticed, especially when you're teaching, you know, kind of introductory stuff, are you seeing a lot of people coming to it, you know?
Yeah. I haven't done any like really introductory stuff in a while. I don't feel like, I feel like I've been kind of focusing on intermediary stuff. And you know, so I've been teaching classes in person again at Dark Star Magic in Portland, which is a blast, by the way. The next time you're in town, if you're here during the day at all, you should go check it out. It's a really cool place.
I'd love to. I follow them on Instagram, and I know they've had a brash of like recent break-ins and stuff, which is unfortunate.
That was crappy,
but they look they look awesome. It's great. I'm glad that there's more shops popping up.
Oh, me too, and especially event spaces. So, and my, I feel like my audience there, the people who show up there, has sort of skewed a little older than I've seen before. Mm-hmm. So it could be that there's things about it that are generational, that that, you know, the I guess what my feeling is, I feel like I'm attracting an older audience now. Like they aren't all like in their 20s looking for their first, you know, taste of the weirdness. They're kind of like, you know, in their 30s or 40s or even older than that, and they maybe they want like a more analytical or more structured approach, or maybe they're looking to incorporate older traditions, or they really like, you know, all the sigils and magic circles and stuff of the Renaissance, or I don't know. Who knows? Or they like math.
Well, it's great.
They like,
for sure. Yeah. There's something for everyone. Yeah.
There is. I really wish that, you know, I mean, those are some really interesting things to think about, and I'm going to think about them. I feel like I don't have any really good insights on them right now. I do know that when I started teaching at Dark Star, one of my first impressions was like, oh, it's not just kids.
Because
that's kind of how I'd been feeling for a while. So that was
kind of cool. And that's interesting. But you have, like I said, the wide breadth of, you know, like topics, no matter level, you know, from adept or whatever downwards. I know that, you know, a big kind of confluence too for you has always been kind of grimoires and, you know, I say archaic, and I feel like it has a negative connotation when I say archaic, but really I just mean dusty old tomes, you know.
They are dusty old tomes for sure.
But like, you know, the progenitors of a lot of traditional craft and currents. And and I just find it interesting how you can delineate, you know, like a sigil class, but also like have some for the folks that are kind of more historically minded and traditional. Yeah.
Well, it turns out a lot of times it's actually kind of easy because, you know, like chaos magic in particular, it reinvented the wheel a lot. So it would, you know, so like, you know, the sigil making process where you like take the alphabet and like break it down, you know, you take your words and remove the vowels and duplicates and like turn it into a symbol and stuff.
Yeah. Austin Osman Spear. Like, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't invent that. You know, Agrippa's got it in 3 books of occult philosophy. The whole thing, you know, like servitors and stuff like that, like that wasn't invented by chaos magic. You know, a lot of the stuff that chaos magic sort of rediscovered was already in older materials and older texts. It just was framed in different language or done in a way that you know maybe isn't entirely identical. But I think that people don't really see that often. So, you know, like I just taught a class on Renaissance sigil magic, and I'm like, here are, you know, 6 ways to make sigils out of grimoires where they totally spell it out for you. You do it this way and this way and this way. And some of it is like really, really free form. You know, I think there's also a lot, there's sort of an impression in modern grimoire magic, by which I mean let me define what that means first. Like modern grimoire magic, you know, so there's sort of been a a renaissance of studying grimoires that probably started in like the early 2000s, maybe mid 2000s. And there's a big school of practitioners and teachers in that area who I sort of call grimoire purists, who are like, you know, there's a structure here. You have to follow all these steps. You have to get all these exact materials. You have to do all these things exactly how they would have done it. Otherwise, you're not working the grimoire. And that's intimidating. That's a lot of stuff to do. It's a lot of old materials to track down. The number of discussions I've had with people who don't realize that parchment is made out of animal skin, for instance, you know,
right?
Like there's a lot of, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of really gross stuff you have to find, a lot of weird ingredients. And I think that there is such an adherence to doing things that old fashioned way that people are sort of forgetting that the reason the authors of the grimoire were doing that, it's because that's all they had.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have paper. They didn't have nice paper. They didn't have cheap paper. They didn't have light bulbs. They had to make their own ink. They definitely didn't have ballpoint pens. You know, I mean, there were all these things that when they're talking about like getting the fancy oil lamp, you know, that's made out of brass, blah, 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 or whatever. They had never seen a light bulb. Like, would they have been thrown off by, you know, an antique desk lamp with an Edison bulb? Like, that's pretty friggin' fancy. Like, why not? What's wrong with that?
I love that you're touching on this, because I think a lot of what I find the roadblocks with people when it comes to that, yeah, is not only like the material hunting, but there seems to be like an implied classist kind of ideology where like you need to be afforded mm-hmm. the time and like the wealth to find these materials, you know, and I don't think that's like necessarily at all what they were meaning. But that, you know, that could be a roadblock. But I also think,
right,
you know, and you'd be great to talk to about this, but like when, yeah, like you were saying, like when is it okay to cook, right? Like when is it okay mm-hmm. to be improvisational? Like how do you delineate what materials were just kind of the time and kind of largely inconsequential, and which ones, you know, you really do need to seek out?
That's a really good question. And I guess I should say that like a lot of the grimoire magic that I focus on is like planetary magic stuff.
Planetary magic,
I think is really well suited to that question, because it tends to focus on like correspondences, right? So,
yeah.
You can find like clues to how the correspondences are supposed to work or how you're supposed to look for them in texts like the Three Books of Occult Philosophy, where it's like, you know, things with, you know, flowers with six petals are, you know, partaking of the sun, or, you know, things that come out at night are partaking of Saturn, or, you know, there are all these little rules like that. So you can kind of look at those and find your own correspondences, you know, because the concept is that like the planetary rays are sort of a wash. The whole world is a wash in them. Everything receives the influences from all the planets.
It's got animus. Yeah.
And you just sort of have to figure out what would be the most, you know, or what things around you, what do you have available? You know, modern witchcraft, like kitchen witchcraft, is like great at this. You know, I remember seeing, you know, like TikTok witches or Instagram witches or whatever talking about, like, if you've got McCormick spices, those are great. Like, you don't need to go find wild basil leaves and pluck them. Like, just use some dried basil. Like, it's going to be fine.
And we
see this in a lot of traditional texts too, because we have some working grimoires from like cunning folk and hedge witches and even like operating sorcerers, like the Sorcerer's Handbook from Venice. Like, we see them making shit up and am I allowed to swear in this show? I'm sorry, I just used an adult word.
Yeah, absolutely. Swear away.
Okay. but we see people using those sorts of things or like improvising all the time. Are you still here? Is Keats gone?
Okay. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, your no swearing problem. Did that.
No, I'm just I'll joking. Do it again.
Yeah.
But anyhow, like I was saying, we see people doing those improvisations a lot in actual working magicians' texts and notebooks and stuff. So it's not old. I mean, it's not new. And yeah, there is sort of almost a classist sort of thing there. Like, who in their right mind is going to be able to afford all of the leather and gold and inscribed chalices and daggers, you know, from like the Key of Solomon,
right? Or can afford, you know, the 6 months of retreat that you need for the Abramelin, you know?
Exactly. but also at the same and you know, and that's okay. You know, we see, for instance, like the pentacles in the Key of Solomon get repurposed in some forms of folk magic, you know, mm-hmm. and that's cool. Like I've experimented with that a little bit, and not only is it cool, but it is actually kind of fun and easy magic, you know, especially nowadays because we've got laser printers and colored paper.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
No, and I love that. I love that confluence of the, you know, kind of modern ramshackle kind of technologies, you know, working within that mm-hmm. those constructs. Like, as you were saying, like, having a laser printer, I mean, a lot of the, you know, sound magic, the ability to, like, you know, work with cassette tapes and drum machines and, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
or, like, you know, sampling kind of tube and throat singing or something and, you know, working with the hemi-sync kind of binaural stuff, just, you know, mm-hmm. with the Walkman. It's just, yeah, it's incredible stuff. But, yeah, I love this idea of this, like, you know, because a lot of my practice, too, is very, it's ramshackle like that. It's very much yeah. like kitchen sink, you know, what do I have around? Like, and I've always loved that. And, yeah, I guess that is very much part and parcel of, like, the cunning folk kind of you know, paradigm or whatever, but I'm seeing a lot more be embraced. Aside from, you know, the, as you were saying, like this, I don't want to say snooty, but kind of snooty, you know, highbrow, traditionalists, yeah. which there's a place for that too. You know, there's a reason why able to study these currents, and that's because people are continuing to charge them, you know, the way mm-hmm. they were done. I'd be hard pressed though to find like documented proof that somebody in this day and age could, you know, to the T, like perform, you know, like a ritual from a grimoire, you know, back then, like to the T with every ingredient, or like, you know, even,
yeah,
you know, goat sacrificing, which it sounds, that sounds right. absurd, but there is a little bit of that, you know.
There is. Yeah. I mean, especially if you go back to the Picatrix or the
right.
or the PGM, like there's lots of animal sacrifice. I mean, I know there are people doing it and there are people trying. Mm-hmm. I for one, am not interested in animal sacrifice, but
yeah.
But you know, we even have modern religions that practice animal sacrifice.
Yep.
I think that frequently there is a misunderstanding of animal sacrifice where people think it's like a waste of the animal, but frequently it's kind of like a ritual killing where the sacrifice is actually.
Yeah. It's like consumed. A kosher, or halal
yeah,
type.
It's like kosher. Yeah.
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 Yeah. yeah.
But I say that just to illustrate, you know, the kind of the lengths one would have to go, you know, to perform some mm-hmm. of these. And, you know, talking about the PGM or something similar. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about this last time, but that unusual phrase or unusual pun intended, because it says to add the usual
yeah.
a lot in the actual, in the grimoire, in your, you know, in your yeah, ritual steps. Yeah. And I love that because to me, it's almost like this foresight of knowing that this is going to be performed outside of this time that it's written, outside of mm-hmm. you know, this government of which we're operating under, outside of, you know, the linguistic barriers. So like, just do what you do, on top of all of these steps.
You know, I hadn't really considered that very carefully in the context of the PGM, but I do use that term. Like, I used to sort of like put together frame rituals for people, or, you know, for classes and stuff. But now I usually do just be like, you know, just do the usual. Open the way you always open, close the way you always close. And then once you've got your space, here's some stuff you do. Because I want there to be jazz in magic. I want people to be making up their own stuff and doing things their own way and having their own sort of relationships with it. Like, I think that's kind of part of the beauty of it. You know, it is supposed to be, you know, a type of performance art, even if it's private. It's like a combination of performance art and prayer, which I did not invent that. Dan Attrell said that, but I am just stealing from him now. Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, no, I love that too. I love that because, yeah, that's quite like literally what I do. With like, you know, within audiomancy or any of the like art constructs of magic, is it's literally performance art and prayer. So yeah, that's a beautiful way to illustrate it, because there is like a pomp and ceremony and a beauty in the drama and getting outside of your comfort, you know, to do these things. That's a sacrificial offering in and of itself, you know, to be put in these vulnerable kind of, you know,
oh, for sure,
huge productions. So that is a part of the usual.
I just realized that, like, I was listening to you talk about it, then I was going to say, and art's like that too, and then I was like, oh wait, he was just talking about performance, wasn't he? But yeah, I mean, but that's, I think, part of the beauty of it, right? Like, there is sort of like, you know, the like magical stage fright, right? Like, you're overcoming sort of like what the hell am I doing? Why am I wearing this weird white bathrobe and a crown of herbs on my head and lighting candles in my living room? Like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. Well, and that's a lot of what was behind, you know, the past year or so, doing these audiomancy, like improvised live streams. And like, part of that was that kind of sacrificial part of, these are all improvised, so anything could happen, and I'm going to be accountable to it because it's going to be streamed live. So it's kind of like a, you know, a humiliation ritual somewhat, you know, but but what it's done is wonders and training kind of a rhythm, like within, to kind of trust yourself when you know, working under this. Like, it's almost like, because when you do perform these rituals, they don't have to be live streamed or documented. You are performing to specters, right? Or to the other, or even to yourself. There is a, like, there is a viewing party of some sort.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, yeah, it's wonderful to think about. See, no, you're not alone. but I was using, so the Divergent Magic book I put out, I found one of the uses recently was actually deconstructing what the usual is. And so I could go back and have it listed, like what these operations are, so that once I create another, you know, ritual, I can couple it with, you know, add the usual at the beginning of the end of this, you know, and then I'd have somewhere, I'd have it, you know, written down and listed. And that's been wonderful in kind of a schematic of like these characteristics of your own personal touch on things that you don't normally look twice at, you know what I mean? But now you can kind of deconstruct and see, like, oh, interesting, these tethers of how I'm doing this. So where does this come from?
How do you, so like, do you find your usual has sort of evolved over time?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I would say I've delineated it into like a few usuals. You know what I mean? Like,
I think I kind of have too. I think I know what you're saying. Sort of like, depending on what system you're working with or what your intent is.
Exactly.
Like even when I just want to like sit down and meditate, I still kind of have a usual before I start, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I love that because it's so intrinsically you too, what this usual is.
Yeah,
and speaking of, you know, meditation, that's something like, have I ever really broken down like what, like just my general meditation practice is? You know, have I documented that before? If it's not like doing a certain type of meditation, like how do I, you know, get into that state? And yeah, finding out like the voices and like constructs of how you talk to yourself to get yourself into these usual spots, you know, has been really interesting.
Yeah. I don't know that I've ever really spent a lot of time paying attention and being aware of that, but I think I'm going to have to now. That's some good insight.
It's interesting. I think it's more humorous than anything. Like there's like an intrinsic humor, I think, to a lot of the stuff that I've found in myself. Like there's a part of me that has this weird kind of objective, like judgmental thing towards me that I find funny, you know, double speak. But yeah, all that to say that I love that, you know, you share that ethos and what you're doing as far as, you know, teaching these grimoires, but also, you know, wanting the jazz, wanting the, you know, the usual, the many usual, right? To be a part of it. And you said you're teaching this Arbitel class at Darkstar. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I actually have a link too, I'll share.
Okay, yeah. I think the Darkstar class is a really, really great example of it, because the Darkstar, or I'm sorry, the Arbitel class is sort of a really great example of what we're talking about, because the Arbitel hardly contains any ritual. It's a lot of just sort of do the usual stuff, but there's nothing in there that requires you to have, you know, fancy daggers or ritual cloaks or anything of that nature. It kind of, you know, the Arbitel is a really, on its surface, kind of a simple grimoire. It's not very long. It's basically 49 aphorisms, or these like short little sayings, except for one of the sayings, which is very long and has all the Olympic spirits in it. And a lot of it sort of contains stuff like, you know, if you want to practice magic, you have to like be a good person. You have to work on being good. Like, you know, don't be covetous. Don't be cruel. Like, you know, try to be good. And that's something that really, really caught my eye a few years ago. I don't know how many years ago, 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more, because I had been working with these sorts of, I want to call them like virtue systems. I sort of think of them as like, they're sort of like practical spirituality. It's like your spirituality, your magical practice in the privacy of your own home is one thing, but what happens when you interface with the world? What happens when you go out and you encounter the world? Like, is your magic affecting you as a person? So in particular, I was attracted to this system called Musar, which is kind of, I guess, a kind of like exoteric Kabbalah. Yeah. And the whole, I think we've talked about this before, haven't we?
Yeah, you've mentioned it before. Yeah.
Yeah. So Musar is all about sort of like finding these sort of like divine traits that we're supposed to emulate, you know, like honesty and loving kindness and all these sorts of things, and sort of nurturing them in yourself. So when I came across this stuff in the Arbitel, I was like, oh, hold on a second. There's like a parallel here that's kind of interesting. But beyond that, the Arbitel does this whole thing where another big element of it is like, this book is about learning secrets and learning how to keep secrets. And the secrets are things that are revealed to you through your practice. So it gives, you know, the Olympic spirits, the seven Olympic spirits, one for each planet, and then their sigils. And then it tells you, like, these aren't the right names or symbols. Like, you're going to have to go find those yourself, and they will be private to you, and they will only be good as long as you're alive, basically. Like you can use these maybe to jumpstart things, but you're really going to have to, you know, try to be good and try to do all these prayers. It doesn't even have a lot of prayers. It has, like, one prayer, right? So there's hardly any real spell work in the Arbitel, just sort of this almost like guide for bootstrapping your own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I've always really, really liked that. But then it also has some elements of grimoire numerology and like remedial math that grimoires seem to love so much, you know. Everything in that book is based on the number seven. Like, it loves the number seven. There's seven septenaries, seven aphorisms in each septenary, seven Olympic spirits. There are seven greater secrets and seven medium secrets and seven lesser secrets and just sevens all over the place, which is really, really entertaining to kind of like dig into. And then it has some other like fun math stuff. Like I found there's a number in there that it sort of mentions as an attribute of one of the spirits. And I was looking at this number and I'm like, why? What's up with this number? It's, what is it? 36,536. And I was like, that's not a multiple of seven. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
So I went and looked, and it is 4567 times eight.
Wow.
They must have, the author of that book must have thought they were being very clever.
I love it. But that's the kind of intrinsic intent that I hold dear in a lot of these, you know.
Me too.
Just that, yeah. It's just you're forever unpacking, and it's like, the Easter egg kingdom, you know.
I love the math Easter eggs and grimoires. So they're just because almost all of the grimoires we have now, maybe all of them, were written before the scientific revolution, right? So they were written before Isaac Newton. They were written before calculus. They were written before Kepler and his planetary laws. So even though they were probably like educated people writing the grimoires, their level of math education compared to like the average modern American's math education is pretty remedial.
Yeah.
So they think they're being really, really clever with this math. And then you go and look at it and you're like, this is the shittiest word problem I've ever seen. Like, why did you write it this way? And when I write it out, why is it like the dumbest equation from like a sixth grade math quiz?
I can see them going, huh, you know.
Yeah, they're like, this is very clever.
Keep your secrets.
No one will understand my secret math.
I love that. There's a part I just wrote down too, because when you're talking about, you know, the Arbitel, and I love this, like, they give you enough to create your own, but they're not going to tell you what they've found. Like,
yeah,
you know, those equation solving is like left up to you, but they give you kind of examples of what, you know, they came across in a way. And I love that. Yeah. Do you find that's kind of another, not to bring it into kind of a big stratosphere type question, but I think with the advent of, you know, broadcasting, you know, us both being practitioners or, you know, writers or artists or whatever, do you find a fine line between what you're willing to share, your own personal findings and like spiritual, you know, kind of, I don't know, goals?
Yeah. I consider it a pretty firm line, I think.
I
think there's a lot of stuff that I won't share, and a lot of experiences that are personal to me. And I think that's something that we get warned about in a lot. You know, the Arbitel has some lines in it, something like, I totally was just typing this out. I bet you it's on my other screen, but it's something like, you know, don't give good meat to the dogs or something like that. And then, you know, like Trithemius, he writes something like, give hay to an ox and sugar to a parrot only. You know, like there are these constant admonitions to, like, you know, the things, the secret experiences, the part of the secret experience and the inner experience is yours alone.
Sure.
And I think that's really important to learn, and I think it's important to kind of stick to that. And I think a big part of that is because, you know, a magician or a virtuous magician who's following these sorts of paths should be humble.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not Absolutely. Super good at that all the time.
But that's what a humble person would say. Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, you know, it's just sort of like in the heat of the moment or getting caught up in just life. I think I can be sort of an arrogant prick every once in a while. So having the reminder that there are these secrets that are like mine that shouldn't be shared. I think it's sort of an important reminder, like, you know, you shouldn't be bragging, you shouldn't be boasting, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I guess I never, when I, you know, was thinking of that question, I didn't really consider the, like, the successes. It's funny, because, like, the way I was visualizing this idea of, like, from the artist, you know, to the practitioner, like, one, I think, is kind of very drawn to sharing good and bad experiences through, I guess there's a secretism and symbology through the art, but like, as you know, as a writer, like I am, my whole thing, especially with like Haunt Manual and stuff, was to talk like warts mainly. Like the successes themselves are basically like, if something was like created, right? It's not, they're not like, oh, I've reached, you know, another echelon of adeptness or something. It's more like sharing the rough and tumbles of a personal practice. And I was wondering, because I'm finding myself now, I think after years now of sharing this type of stuff or discussing this stuff, like, yeah, there are some things that like, I don't need to paint myself that naked all the time, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think maybe that might be part of the difference between or I don't know if difference is the right word, but I think that, you know, when you are making art that is meant to be shared and performed, you know, that's something where the goal is to show off what you're doing and what you are creating, right? Like that is specifically made to share. Even if it's magically operant work, it's still something that's being made specifically to share.
Yeah.
So like some magical work though, that isn't, that is sort of, it's like writing in your diary or writing like secret poems in your diary. Like you might be pouring your heart out and you might still be creating art, but it's not really for consumption outside. And that's okay. It's okay to have private things. You know, we all have a private life that exists in our imaginal world. And, and you know, there's never any way to portray it perfectly.
Yeah. And I find it so enlightening that the idea, you know, I think most people would get very annoyed because it's not paint by numbers, do this, receive this sort of thing. And I personally, that's why I love it, because it's almost exemplifying the process. It's like, if you were interested in this, you'd have to do this yourself to kind of, you know, see what you discover. And I love that about the Arbitel. It's clever, but it's also like really enticing as far as like sharing within a practice. Like you don't need to, you know, give your own personal experience as much as, you know, basically giving them an example, right?
Yeah. I think the big thing about it is you're kind of like, you're setting them up for their own personal experience.
Right.
So I think because of that, I don't really consider the Arbitel to be, you know, the best grimoire for beginners.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, because you already have to have the usual down before you go in there, because it's not giving it to you.
Yeah.
So I would say that, like, it's an intermediate level book. It's like the thing that gets you set up for moving into advanced stuff. You know, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating how, like, you've kind of... Talking about, you know, applied kind of modern, you know, tactics to working with these grimoires, that secret, you know, mechanism of it just like really spoke to me, especially as, you know, I'm sure it has spoken to you as being a broadcaster, as being a writer within all of this stuff. So you're already finding like an application of it through how you're teaching the knowledge, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, and it makes it tough. You know, I teach art of memory classes a lot.
That's right. Yeah.
And the art of memory, especially the way I use it, is to me very private. And the feedback I always get is like, we want some examples. And I'm always like, oh God. So it makes me have to like go back and think of how to present examples that aren't necessarily things that I've used. Right. Because,
right.
Because, you know, a big part of the art of memory is like mnemonic images that can be very personal or very, you know, revealing about my inner life that aren't necessarily meant for other people to see.
So, right. Yeah. So and like art, you so, sharing yeah. that alone could also like, it should just muddy the waters. You know, they could focusing on something they shouldn't be. So, yeah,
exactly. So I've done stuff where I've like just worked on getting good at coming up with memory images on the spot that are, you know, good to share and stuff. But I guess in summation,
yeah.
I do find that there is a pretty firm line for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I guess you'd have to be too. There's also kind of a journalistic aspect to all of it, especially mm-hmm. as a, you know, a writer and a teacher. And so, yeah, you kind of have to have like an ethos. You have to have a set of like ethics or, you know, kind of modes that of ways of kind of dispelling things, but also illuminating things. So, yeah, I find that really interesting. And I know you for a long time have worked with the art of memory. And I love that in the sense that I remember reading once somebody asked a magician, I forget who exactly, but they asked him, you know, what's the best book I could get to begin magic? And they shared a critical thinking book, you know, and I love that, you know, I was like, that's great. Yeah, of course, because you do kind of need those, you know, those kind of basics of, of like introspection and of modality to like, you know, work through mm-hmm. before getting into this. And memory really speaks to me in that sense, because I'm sure you're finding that cross like pollination kind of in everything you do, the art of memory.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The art of memory, I think a lot of people don't know or maybe not be familiar with how prevalent and everywhere it was, you know, up through, you know, the 1500s and into the 1600s. You know, the printing press kind of killed it, but it was a really, really common practice. It's alluded to in the Arbitel, actually. The Arbitel mentions the art of memory. You see it all over the place in some of that older stuff. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've been trying to get across to people is that Renaissance magic, like grimoire magic, is imaginal. You know, it relies very heavily on the world of the imagination and the inner vision, you know, and I mean, and this is just such a huge part of it. It comes up over and over and over again. It's easy to ignore, you know, and but it's still there, and it's one of the biggest, I think, hurdles that people have to get over in order to approach this stuff, or even approach magic in general. Is you can't do magic without imagination.
Sure,
like it's impossible.
In the word. Yeah.
Yeah. are we going to make up a new word? Imagination.
Nope.
Imagination.
Don't get me started on portmanteaus. I'll be here all day.
Port imagination.
Yeah. But no, I love that. Like, you know, for somebody that is going to take your class, do you give, you know, a kind of like a list of prerequisites, for lack of a better term, or like kind of material for somebody that wants to take an Arbitel class like you have coming up, and I put the link in the chat. It's also in the description. But do you kind of let people know what they should prime themselves with maybe before jumping in?
Probably not as much as I should, but I kind of figure that anybody who already knows what the Arbitel is they're going to be at least somewhat familiar. Just like, you know, anybody who is watching this stream or listens to either of our podcasts is probably, you know, done an LBRP or made a sigil before. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. they're not green.
Right.
So I don't they're worry purple. About that a whole lot. Did you say they're purple?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? It's a good color.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I guess you're right too. And to have like, you know, the whole thing of, you know, purchasing the class, finding it out, like there is mm-hmm. already kind of an implied, yeah.
Yeah.
Familiarity with it all. But,
Yeah. It makes me think, actually, there's this line in the Arbitel that says, magicians can't be made. They're born that way from their mother's womb. Mm-hmm. And I read that and I was sort of like, well, shit, how are we supposed to know? How are we supposed to know if it's for us? And then I was like, probably we don't need to worry about it. You know, if our life's path has led us down this road and has led us to the Arbitel and has led us to working with it, it's probably what we were meant to do.
Yeah. It was probably birthed in the womb.
Yeah.
But I love that. Yeah. Cause it's true. It's, you know, there's such a huge intuitive aspect to it all. Like it's got to sing with you. I do, you know, I think there is a place that might've a couple of years ago, might've been a little persnickety about, you know, just the academics, non-practitioners or something, which I see there's a wonderful place for those too. And it's not on them that none of the currents of which they studied didn't sing to them enough to practice it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But have the knowledge and like the passion and the drive to kind of, you know, research, all these currents. So yeah, you're right. It's like, it's got to sing to you, or it doesn't, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think that's definitely, I think that's better than I put it.
So with the, the Agrippa, the three, occult books, I know that there's maybe some roadblocks and folks, there's a lot of linguistic roadblocks or maybe, more of like, the way it's written, right? It may not be digestible. Like, have you found any kind of methods for folks to maybe get over the sense of, you know, maybe those sort of linguistic, roadblocks? I'll just keep saying that.
Well, I'm having a linguistic roadblock. I think right that now. The best way to get over the linguistic roadblock is to get Eric Perdue's translation. Like his.
Okay.
Because he released a new translation a few years ago. And it's good. It's really good. Like, it's readable. It's got footnotes. It kind of tells you what's going on. It helps a lot. Like, with Agrippa in particular, three books of occult philosophy, the biggest roadblock is just that it's friggin' enormous.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's huge. And large parts of it kind of read like nonsense to the modern reader. Mm-hmm. Especially Agrippa's... sort of like natural science, natural history sort of stuff, a lot of which is cribbed from Pliny the Elder. So there's like a lot of weird bullshit in it. So you have to wade through a lot of stuff. It takes patience. Three books of occult philosophy, it requires a little bit of patience and giving yourself license to roll your eyes when needed.
Yeah. As it means, that objective, judgmental ghost of yourself that can laugh.
You need the critical thinking class. But I think also that as you start to get into it, you have to understand like when Agrippa is sort of speaking literally and when he is speaking in a way that doesn't necessarily require us to, abandon 400 years of science, you know,
right.
Three books of occult philosophy was published in 1535. Like Agrippa never even got a chance to read, Copernicus. You know, he had no concept of the modern view of the cosmos or the world or whatever. Like he comes from a time that is very alien, but also strangely familiar to us.
Sure.
And so that can be confusing. It can be really tempting to just throw everything out.
Yeah,
but But what I've found is once you start getting into places where he's talking about, you know, the role of imagination or the role of divine light or his approach to sort of viewing the, I mean, this is not the right word. I was going to say the calculus of the world, but that's really not the machine of the cosmos and how things are interconnected. And, you know, he's got these beautiful passages on
the music of the spheres.
Yeah. The music of the spheres, the divine frenzy, you know, like Agrippa is a huge proponent for like listening to sort of like the inner self and trusting intuition or trusting visions and dreams and all these sorts of things. So there's a lot of like really gorgeous stuff in the three books of occult philosophy, as well as like a lot of hints as to finding like beauty in contemplation, perhaps.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's almost like finding animus in one's own thoughts themselves. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But also a huge thing that I think is really important in Agrippa is his approach to the inner world as a method of perception. So, you know, the imagination isn't just something that you are creating, but it is something that receives impressions from the celestial world or from the spirit world around you or whatever. So,
right. There's an imaginarium that we're all tapping or creating. And
So for him, you know, no man is an island, I guess. Nobody is an island, even in your imagination, even in the private world of your imagination. There are still impressions and senses and images that are impressed on you from without, from beyond. And so, you know, I think a big part of that is really important. His sections on planetary magic and astrological magic are still incredibly influential. You know, a lot of modern astrologers who are doing astrological magic are still relying on Agrippa for a ton of that stuff.
Oh yeah.
And in addition, of course, anybody who's interested in sigil magic, you know, Agrippa's approach to sigils and their relationship with sort of like astrology and astromechanics or whatever, I think is like intrinsic. And so, and it's gorgeous, right? Like it's beautiful stuff.
The magic squares
But like, even if you aren't a fan of astrology, the combination of astrology and the crafting of sigils is kind of poignant because it is a way of encoding sort of like time and space into your magical artwork, which I think is kind of cool. So I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been, you know, I made a whole podcast series on Agrippa, and then I've been working on turning it into a book. So I'm writing a book. It's taking me forever. I'm like 90% done, but I've been 90%.
I know,
like 6 months.
Well, it was so funny because when we were talking, and we were talking about possible subjects, like it seemed like we both had hit that synchronous, you know, kind of modern applications of these otherwise kind of archaic, you know, currents and whatnot. And you told me that you were working on a book kind of about that, right?
Yeah. I think, my book is very much sort of focused on bringing, you know, making Agrippa relevant for the 21st century magician. Like, how can you take Agrippa seriously, and what can you take seriously? What do you absolutely have to throw out? What is deserving of attention? Like, so, and, you know, I mean, there's a ton of it in there. Like, his stuff on correspondences is super important. His sort of like approach to the cosmology of spirits is sort of like a really huge part of modern magic, but it is rarely looked at very closely. So, you know, that's, I think, something that's important to dig into. And then his stuff on imagination, And then kind of just understanding some of the things. Like he leaves a lot of secrets too. He leaves a lot of stuff where,
yeah,
you know, he's like, here's a thing I know exists, but I don't know how to do it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I love that in, I think, not to make it about me, but just as like a personal experience, you know, parallel is that, yeah, it's like haunt manual or whatever. It's not an actual manual for somebody to do, like to, you know, mm-hmm. like to perform these exact things. It's more of like a collection of like how somebody created their own in a way. And like right. These are the findings. So maybe it's like more intrinsically motivating about the way towards magic and artistry or whatever, you know. And I can see that in like Agrippa or the Arbitel, like they have, there's like a spectrum of that as well. Like mm-hmm. you know, here are these kind of you know, these equations, right? And these are the possible ways to do it, but like again, we're not gonna, you know, flesh them out entirely, but still there's like there's a method, there's like a magical motivation, like a missing link, I think, in a lot of you know, these works that I find a lot of people ask me when they're starting. It's like, yeah, but I need magic to be motivated to do magic, you know. Like I need an operation to give me some drive into you know, getting in the deep end of all this stuff. So mm-hmm. yeah, have you come across that at all in your teaching? Have folks kind of, you know, just had a hard time with that first step?
I think everybody has a hard time with that first step.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you and I probably just don't remember it very well because it was a while ago. But like,
oh, I remember it every day. Yeah, it's still really,
happening. Yeah, I mean. Yeah, I still have it too. Yeah, because I mean, you go through long periods of not doing shit, you know, where your altar just sits there mm-hmm. and collects dust or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I usually just tell people that the they just have to make the jump. Like, you just have to just go do something. Like, go do a ritual. See what it feels like. Go sit and meditate for 5 minutes. See how it goes.
Yeah, do a ritual to do rituals, and when you're doing that, you would have done a ritual, so you're doing the ritual.
Fastest way to make magic work.
Yeah. To do magic to make magic. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I love that. We did have a question from Instagram. WooWoo122 says, so where should I look to find Agrippa's thoughts on sigils? Maybe I'll wait for your book. That and the books of occult philosophy.
I mean, you should. I mean, God, let's see. It's in book three. Oh, wait. I think it's later in book two. But just flip through until you find the parts with the magical alphabets, because it's right around there.
Right around
there. Yeah.
And you'll see.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, oh,
you should wait for his book.
Yeah, but I do have a class on it called Renaissance Sigils. It's just, I don't think I have it offered online yet, but I'll be doing that soon.
Beautiful. Yeah, and some folks on YouTube. We got Oswald Spangler, who's ready for the keytar. That's
hi,
coming.
Hi, Oswald Spangler.
You know, famed philosopher.
Oswald yes.
Luciferius. What's up, dude?
Hey, Luciferius, Knock how's it going? Day. Man, it's been a while since I talked to him.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, should I play some keytar?
You should, let's break out some keytar. Let's hear some applied magical jazz.
All right, I'm going to warn everybody that I'm not very good at music. Let me give a little bit of background on the keytar. So when I was a child, when I was very young, back in the 20th century, I took piano lessons for like 10 years, but then I didn't touch keyboards for ages. Like, even when Keats, when you and I first met, I lost him again.
Oh no, I'm still here. I just wanted to give you full screen.
Even like when you and I first met, like I wasn't doing any music then, but, I was given a digital piano, like, I don't know, 2019 maybe. And I started practicing again. And then, when I was on, Lux's, podcast, we made some sort of joke about keytars, and the idea got stuck in my head. So I did end up getting a keytar. So I have a keytar here. It's going through a Korg Volca FM2, which is a FM synthesizer. And I didn't practice any songs, so I'm just going to make some shit up.
I'm going to go ahead and mute and give you the spotlight.
I'm
going
to mute my microphone, and if you tell me that if you want me to stop, you just have to yell at me.
Sounds good.
Okay. And just a little bit of synthesizer abuse.
I loved it. Yeah, going through the vocal as you're basically like your synth brain, because that's a MIDI trigger, really, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just a synthesizer with a keyboard attached. But you know, the Volcas are they're these little itty bitty units. I could hold mine up, but it's got all these wires plugged into it.
Yeah, same with mine. But they're super affordable for folks looking to get into like modular synthesized music that's hardware based and you don't need a computer. You don't even need to do it MIDI. They can be standalone. They're perfect. They're like $150 bucks. They're Korg. They sound great. They're classic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of them are battery operated too. So like they're just so handy. Yeah. They're really great little things. I guess one of the weird things about learning keyboards again has been like breaking out of all the stuff that I learned as a kid, because I was never really told to just screw around on the piano as a kid. It's always like, you know, learn this classical piano, learn how to play this piece. And it was all sheet music all the time. So it's been a journey of like relearning skills that I had and then breaking things that I'd learned. And then I'm really interested in learning how to just improvise. And I mean, you know, I'm okay. It's coming along.
I love it. No, man, that's great. Hopefully I'm still trying to work out getting down to Portland next week. Mm-hmm. But hopefully there can be an improvised session with all of that.
I hope so.
Yeah. Because honestly, I was just going to say, like, improvisation, you know, it's something, like, I was never really a fan as, like, an audience member so much. Not in, like, the construct of, like, you know, American, like, rock and roll, like, improvised music. Yeah. Just, you know, but what I found is that transposition of, you know, like, this ramshackle kind of metaphysical workings is improvised communion, right? And then putting that with music and all the talismans or instruments and tools and like, this intuitive kind of dance or choreography with it has like, it's just been a wellspring of inspiration, really.
Yeah, I guess it's more like when you're one of the improvisers, it's more meaningful than when you're one of the audience members.
Sure, and it would have to be, you know, obviously there's exceptions, and you know, I listen to, you know, Max Roach improvise on drums all day, every day.
Oh yeah, but, for sure.
You know, there's just a lot of like form fitting kind of maybe genres or whatever. All I'm saying is that I think like improvisation isn't kind of just beholden to like the style of music. I think it's widely understood as like either jazz or, you know, fish or something, you know?
Yeah. So, well, blues has, yeah. And so I kind of started playing around with jazz. Jazz is hard.
Yeah.
But because I was sort of like, oh, you know, if I'm going to play the piano and sound cool, I should learn how to play the blues. So I started playing the blues. But then blues has a lot of rules. And I was like, this is annoying. I want something without rules. And so,
yeah, I guess,
there's
some
sense of jazz that doesn't have rules, but also it does because people still want it to sound like music.
So, yeah, it's interesting how these, you know, these theorists and like, you know, musicologists or whatever, like have put these kind of rules on stuff, because when I think of blues, what I grew up on and what kind of inspires me to this day are people like, you know, Skip James or you know, Mississippi John Hurt, or you know, like these Delta kind of blues guys that, you know, with a three string broken acoustic, they don't know their tunings, they're like literally just feeling the instrument and the emotion, right, coming from what they're singing about to the rhythm. Like there's not really any rules there at all. You know what I mean? If anything, the rule would be, you know, to not have them be so stringent. So
yeah. And I think another thing that I've been trying to get comfortable with is sort of like the negative space of silence.
Yeah.
When you're playing.
Yeah.
Like that's a hard one. Piano just always feels like this instrument that's just supposed to fill up all available space. But you can't do that on the guitar because you only have one hand.
That's a great operation to discover too, I think, is knowing when to choke, like knowing when to not play is just as valuable as when to play. I mean, I find even just in my composition, like I've noticed how busy my shit can get, and it's like a muscle you have to exercise, when to like breathe in a composition or breathe when you're playing, you know, and people will fill up every waking moment with a sound, you know? So,
yeah. Yeah. No, but I do have like, so, one of the other things that kind of got me started on improvising music was incorporating it into magical ritual. And this is one of the things we were talking about before. Like, you know, I feel like I'm kind of a music dummy. Like, I'm not really awesome at it or anything like that. But when I was first sort of thinking about this, my friend Drake the Swamp Wizard, who maybe he's watching us right now, I don't even know. But he convinced me to get a lira, a seven-stringed lyre, you know, and you can't really, you basically just open tune those, and you can't go wrong. Anything you play on them sounds good. But they are, like, so I started to discover that you can kind of use them as sort of like this rhythmic instrument while you're meditating, and you just sit there, and you just sort of like, droom, 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 and from there, I started to get a little bit more creative with music during ritual. But, you know, like one of the, like my primary magical group does sort of like a lot of PGM stuff. And they really enjoy just improvised lyra music during ritual. Like they, so I kind of also really want to encourage magicians to be musicians, even if you are the shittiest musician on the planet. Like, get a tambourine with a drum head on it and just go thunk, thunk, thunk while you're doing your ritual. And it adds like this incredible, it's almost as, it's probably better than incense for making ritual better.
No, I mean, I agree. That's been my like biggest, that's been the biggest confluence in my life has been that, those two things kind of tethered together for like a third mind situation, you know?
Because it was
almost pragmatic how I came to like the metaphysical leanings was because I was reaching states of consciousness or, you know, like a sort of hypnagogia, like through my musical like creation or, you know, constructions and stuff. And then it was like, where is this coming from? What am I tapping into? And you find real easily like the rhythms, you know, the psychic exhaust of actually like interacting with the somatic while you're transdimensionally wayfaring somewhere else is like very it's like very matter of fact of what, you know, praxis is. And yeah, I love that. I agree with you. I think I would give a little caveat. I think everybody that's interested in magic, I think music would be the perfect like motivational jumping off point. Just getting through the idea that you're not good or you can't play and picking up something and just going for it. That's a magical rite in and of itself, you know? And I think that's a great introductory portion to it. But I would also say making sure that it's like there is some somatic interaction, making sure that there is beautiful. Yeah. Making sure that there is like a, there's a way that you are kind of dancing with the, you know, somatic, the kind of physical, as well as, you know, hitting these things. I think you'll find like true grounding, like true purpose within that. Cause I think you can, and I have, but I'm not sure if it was more psychosis, but like you can reach these states, you know, programming, your own samples in a MIDI, you know, thing, hours on end, but that might be just blue light fever. I don't know. They all probably come from the same place, but I think it's important for me, especially, is to leave kind of a lot of the digital stuff, like more analog than digital, if that makes sense. I love the confluence of the two for sure, but I think the interaction, like the body kind of physical interactivity, whether it's singing, hitting, you know, strumming, whatever, is very important to that.
I mean, they're definite. Actually, and that's part of the performance, part of ritual too, like the physical performance. Like you should be, you should have motion and movement. But yeah, this is the lira that I was talking about. They're cheap. You can get them on Amazon. There's like all different types of them. I haven't tuned this in a long time, so if I strum this, it'll sound probably horrific.
I like it. I like Discord though. I find harmony in Discord, but no, that's that's beautiful. I, you know, of course, my mind is all automatically put a contact mic on that thing, run it through a delay, you know. And now, you know, since the show that you were at No Fun in Portland, finally, I've been threatening about doing this forever because I've been playing with Ash Plains Adrian, who does MIDI triggering with original footage live in the projections. And so, you know, I got home and rebuilt a new suitcase. I'm adding my 4-track like cassette player. It can be standalone musically, all analog, you know, or I have that little like, Focusrite interface that I just throw into a laptop and I can trigger my own footage and like do actual videomancy kind of interactivity, you know? So it's not just musical. It's like working with almost memory and like, you know,
Are you going to use your Volca drums to, as the MIDI trigger for that? Or are you going to have some other thing?
So
like a big MIDI button, just a one button instrument.
No. So right now what I have is I have basically, then like the cassette tape loops, the the drum machine, maybe my own hardware effects. I have them running through it, and then depending on the footage, like I can trigger like, you know, over this hertz, you know, trigger the opacity here, like every bass kick, do this, every tape loop that comes in, play this footage or whatever. So it's like it's all reactive, but it's that kind of talismanic building your universe, you know. It's like, that's not awesome. Only are you constructing all the sound and like through ritual, but you're also interacting with footage, with like a four-dimensional almost like projection and construct of things. Yeah. So
that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
And the tape looper, does it send out MIDI signals too?
No. It's purely analog. Yeah. It's just cool. It's my four track.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, yeah, cassette. Because when you saw me at the show, I was using like just a cheapo handheld cassette thing and was like, this is ridiculous. When I have, you know, four tracks where I've recorded, you know, on different tracks and I could actually live mix things, you know, from the four tracks. So, but yeah, this is cool. All coming back to this ramshackle kind of kitchen sink, like, what I have around, being magnanimous with like otherwise mundane, you know, applications of music. And like, yeah, igniting those little processes and having real fun, like creating, you know, a space, a magical space or a world basically. Right. So,
Sure.
And that's all this is all like affordable stuff too. It's not, what I loved about you talking about the Korg Volca, or people, if they're wanting to break into this, they don't even, you don't need an expensive laptop. You could use your phone, you know, like, oh, man, there are all these ways to.
Yeah. Like, and there are some super, super cheap MIDI controllers that are still great, you know? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Go to Goodwill. You can, I have
A
collection of old Casio tones from the 80s, and you can find one for $20, and they probably even have a MIDI adapter or like a turnover, you know, in their box of wires. Like, Goodwill has been, that's probably the cathedral for ramshackle magic. Goodwill.
I'm afraid to go to Goodwill because I know that I'm just going to come home with more junk, and I have already way more keyboards than I have hands. And I feel like there should be a cat rule. You know, the cat rule, like your household is on the verge of becoming a crazy cat house if you have more cats than hands to pet them with.
I love that. Yeah, it's a good rule.
And I feel
rule
like there of, might be yeah. yeah, the rule of cat. I feel like there might be a rule of keyboard that is similar to that.
Yeah. Well, this is the issue, right, with the ramshackle magic is like the suitcase that I've spent all this time laboring over and working with Signal Flow, like all of what I'm doing with it can be done with a laptop. You don't need all of that, but like, it's the process of actually having the physical, you know, the artifacts and like the way to manipulate and to physically interact, you know, with things and the magnetic, you know, correspondence with the tape and like all of these like beautiful old machines that, you know, take up so much space, but you only use one, you only need it for one small part, you know, or one little thing.
Plus laptops are fragile and delicate and expensive, and you don't want to take them around places. Like,
well, yeah, and unfortunately, until I can afford, you know, Super 8 camcorders and like overhead projection, that, you know, I can, I don't know, grow more limbs to physically operate, you know. Unfortunately, like after years so you can of break saying
the rule of cat,
after years of saying no laptops live, because back in 2004 to like 2007, I was performing with a laptop that was old at that time. You know what I mean? And breakdowns and just quality issues, and it burned me forever to never you know, perform with laptops. But we've got so far and the technology's gotten good enough that it should be fine. I just can't get around the video and the projection stuff without a laptop. But, you know, it's taking years to fit all of these things in a suitcase. You know what I mean? Like, it's taken years of trial and error to figure out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you have to find the exact right gear that does exactly what you need it to. And then you have to figure out if there's a small version of it. Yeah. I mean, I went through that same thing, like, because I want to be able to perform live with the keytar, but I don't want to haul around a giant synth unit.
Right.
So the tiny Korg was so perfect. I'm like, oh, I mean, it makes noise. Like it sounds enough like an electric piano, you know, before I hit any of the switches and stuff.
It sounds
enough like an electric piano that it's fine.
Yeah. It sounds like a synth.
Which is cool. No, I love synth.
Well, it's great. It's hardware too. Like that's what I was saying. It's got an out. Mm-hmm. You can plug that thing into an amp and you're fine. There's no need to bring a laptop into this transaction. Right. You know? Mm-hmm. And I like that.
I did get an amp. I got a $20 battery powered, like I think it's like 3-watt or 5-watt amp. And it's
like
sounds
a pig nose.
Yeah. Oh, worse than that. Yeah. but like a little cheap thing like that. And I mean it can get loud, but it makes everything sound like a super bad surfer guitar.
I love it. That's my jam.
I know.
But I was going to say, you know, the next step is to fasten a utility belt that holds the Volca and the amp and to busk with it. Just to walk around.
That's my next goal. That's my next goal.
Your next attainable goal. Yeah,
I'm going to go busking. I think at first I'll probably be kind of stationary in one spot, but I'm definitely going to go busking. So anybody who lives in Portland, start carrying loose change.
Yeah.
For buskers, for guitar buskers.
Throw change at somebody. Yeah, Harmony and discord. That's exactly what a solitary would say. Thank you, Oswald. I think it's like was Oswald Spengler like the father of nihilism or whatever?
I have no
telling
idea.
Me I'm a solitary lunatic.
I mean, it's a familiar name, but I feel like the profile picture there kind of reminds me of the main character from The Shield.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Be a Utiful. I think this was about your lyre, lyra. Oswald Spengler also says, would a harmonica that only plays the note of C be called a charmonica or carmonica?
Well, I mean, oddly enough, harmonicas tend to be keyed, you know, so you would get a C harmonica for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it would, you know, evolve into a Charmazard.
I love it. It's final form. he says the profile pick is the Italian singer Marco Beasley.
Beasley. Okay. All right.
Not related to Aubrey Beasley. That's Beardsley. Never mind.
That's Beardsley.
Never mind. Well, great. Yeah. So other than, you know, the upcoming Arbitel class, Arnomancy, the podcast, which is still going strong. I think we did touch a little bit about your most recent episode just in the subject of, you know, the kind of coaching or like the what was the term you used that your guest was talking about? It's like a spiritual.
Oh, you're talking about Nick Letursky, Dr. Nick, right?
Yeah.
He called it spiritual counseling, I believe.
Counseling. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of a really interesting topic. I am very curious about that. Dr. Letursky is really, really cool. That's definitely an episode worth checking out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was funny because, you know, when we were talking about teaching and like the impetus of teaching and especially with all these kind of threads, like if you've, you know, considered jumping into that or, you know, what are your findings after speaking with the doctor? Like, is that kind of a lose situation?
It takes schooling, and I'm bad at taking classes. I'm bad at being in school. I'm not good at homework. I'm also not certain. I'm not certain that that's a path that I'm necessarily called towards.
Right.
So I don't know. I think I'd be more interested in going to a spiritual counselor than being one.
Right. Yeah. I just see a lot of times when folks are kind of in the trades of teaching a culture, or, you know, occult knowledge of some sort, that they also double dip into, spiritual counseling. And what's funny is,
too.
I wonder, I guess maybe this is the last topic or the last point to discuss, but can somebody be a great preacher that can't practice?
Well, that's a, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that somebody who doesn't practice magic could teach magic.
Okay.
But at the same time, apparently Eliphas Levy never practiced, and everybody thinks he was the bee's knees. So
yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. I don't necessarily know. I mean, I think it probably depends on what you're teaching, you know? I mean,
right.
Since so much of the stuff that I'm teaching is like getting people to have these sorts of spiritual experiences in a very subjective internal world, if I hadn't been practicing that myself, how would I tell them how to get there?
Right. I suppose, and to tie it in with the spiritual counseling too, it's like, would you want to take advice from somebody with like sound experience, or do you want to take advice from somebody that's been through the similar rigmarole or whatever, or like the trials and tribulations? Yeah.
Oh yeah. I think Dr. Litersky did a really good job. I keep wanting to just call him Nick because he's my buddy. We have alleged stuff, but you know, Dr. Litersky, he does a really good job sort of outlining that too. He has some example stories that some of his clients gave him permission to share, where you listen to him and you're like, I would not know what to think about the advice that I would be getting on this particular issue if I didn't have confidence that the person giving me the advice had gone through some sort of spiritual experience or magical training or magical practice or something. Like sometimes you need to have gone through all the shitty fire before you can tell somebody how to put it out, right? Like how else are you qualified? I mean, maybe that's what the schooling part is about. See, I don't know. I'm not qualified to talk about this all the time.
Yeah. I know these are big questions to end on, but it is kind of, I think, relevant, especially for somebody that works within the fields. Also, you know, to touch on what we started talking about in the beginning, kind of this, the cultural zeitgeist of folks looking into this. And then, you know, with that comes the influx of folks that probably shouldn't be teaching or counseling that are, or, you know,
oh my God, like tarot readers who don't know what they're doing. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's funny, like I do enjoy doing divination for people, but I don't think that it's the same thing as spiritual. It's not the same thing as spiritual counseling. It's nowhere close, right? Like the diviner tries to get people to look at things from a different perspective or opens up doors of perception, and spiritual counselor is there for something a lot different. So yeah
for sure. Yeah, I didn't mean to use that as like a catch-all for that kind of
oeuvre.
Or whatever, but yeah we're on the same page with that. But yeah, I know, big things to think about, but all that to say, you know, I think you're a magnanimous and wonderful teacher.
I think you're an incredible musician. I love what you're doing.
I think it's great that, yeah. And I think, you know, we definitely are, in the same kind of area of things right now, you know, that, how do I say it? I don't know. There's like a lot of parallels, and I love that you're, you know, really opening up musically. And I love that, you know, you're helping aid in kind of the applications of, or opening the roadblocks that people might have about, you know, these old grimoires. So your work is appreciated.
I'd like to. I mean, I feel like if nothing else, we're in an occult renaissance out there, and I want to see some cool innovation that builds on some of this old grimoire stuff. So the best way to do that is to get people to look at it and stuff, and then go play music about
it. And make art, because art is magic.